Hey everyone, and welcome to this part two of our not-so-accurately named June Snake Oilers edition. I'm Patrick Gray. If you're a first-time listener, this is not our weekly show. This is Snake Oilers. Snake Oilers is a wholly sponsored podcast series we do a few of every year here at Risky Biz HQ. The idea is we get a bunch of vendors together and they pitch their tech in a straightforward way to you, the listeners. Less stops advanced cyber threats and more here's what our stuff does and how it works. And yeah, you're hearing this instead of a weekly show because I'm currently on a beach somewhere tropical. This is a recording. We've got two vendors coming up for you in this podcast. We've got Next Gen Seam Platform Company Exabeam and email filtering giant Proofpoint. Exabeam will be along soon to talk about what a next-gen seam actually is. And yeah, the seam space has legitimately moved on from the bad old days of a one-dimensional event log. Exabeam's VP of product, Anu Yamanan, will be along soon to talk about that. But we'll kick it off with Proofpoint in this edition, and our sponsor guest from Proofpoint is Ryan Callumber. Ryan is the SVP of cybersecurity strategy at Proofpoint, and regular listeners would have heard him pop up here and there on other Risky Business podcasts. Ryan knows an awful lot about email security, and he's joining us this time to talk about a few things. A big selling point he wants to hit home this week is that Proofpoint offers its clients dedicated IPs for their outbound mail servers, and that means you won't be blocked when someone else using the same IPs for outbound mail starts sending spam. And believe it or not, this is a thing that actually happens to users on other mail filtering platforms. From there, Ryan spells out Proofpoint's approach to combating credential phishing, and we talk about some other stuff too. We started off by talking about how some organizations are getting blocked because their filtering provider is sharing IPs between clients. And here's what Ryan had to say.
This happens more often than you'd think. It's a common occurrence for someone else who just happens to be on your tenant to basically get your IP range for sending email in trouble. And everyone's moved to these things like Office 365, where multi-tenancy is the rule, and there's not really a way around that. And whenever your outbound email is blocked, that's a bad day. If SAP goes down, you might take 10 minutes to notice that. If outbound email goes down, your CEO notices in 90 seconds flat.
Yeah, you're going to get yelled at, right? And we were speaking before I hit the record button on this interview, and it really is the case that like detection rates are one thing, but losing, and there might be competitive edges versus one provider versus the other, but this is a bit of a deal breaker, right? If you're routinely losing the ability to send outbound mail, and this is stuff that I've spoken to companies that are using mail filtering services where this has happened more than once.
And that's absolutely common. And that makes it even less forgivable, frankly, for vendors not to be able to support giving you your own IP addresses. So that, yes, if some of your accounts get compromised and you start sending outbound spam, you kind of deserve it when you do get blocked. When it's a deeply unfair thing that happens because other people that just happen to share your IP themselves got compromised due to their own poor hygiene, that's when you feel like yelling at the universe. And it's not easy to fix also. A lot of the vendors don't have necessarily a lot of tools in their toolkit to resolve these situations when they do occur. And companies can be losing money every minute that mail is down.
It's funny too, and I will want to get this into the interview that Microsoft and Google force customers onto, shared IPs, but obviously Google has a lot of clout, so block lists aren't that much of a threat. But you did tell me something interesting, which is the level of outbound nastiness coming out of Microsoft's SMTP boxes is like way higher than Google's.
It is, and for whatever reason, that outbound problem out of Office 365 has continued to be a challenge. We actually think that because Office 365 is effectively free and it is so commonly deployed basically all around the world, a lot of the threat actors are probably getting free accounts on Office 365, testing both sending and receiving their campaigns, because, of course, why wouldn't you? It's going to massively impact your deliverability rates, and that's your bottom line as a cyber criminal. And because of that, you actually open up to all kinds of nastiness that for whatever reason, Office 365 just has a problem with right now. They're not doing as good of a job as Google is.
No, they're not. Now, look, Snake Oilers is all about pitching things that, make certain products unique or pitching aspects of products that make them desirable. You actually came to me with a really interesting point, right? Which is that gateway devices and desktop AV are not very good at spotting credential phishing domains, or credential phishing sites, particularly ones that are hosted on legitimate domains. Whereas if you're looking for that stuff with your mail filtering, you're actually capturing a bit of context around that URL, and it's your best place to do detection for credential phishing.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's become really interesting about the whole credfish landscape, and you know, the guys at Duo have done some great research into this, is there's been this proliferation of fish kits, almost all of which get hosted for really meaningfully interesting campaigns on compromised legitimate websites. Every time there's a WordPress vulnerability, every time there's a Drupal vulnerability, this just opens up hundreds of thousands of newly compromised websites, and an attacker has to burn one or two of them per campaign. Right. And those compromised websites can be used to host these fish kits, which give you a whole lot less to analyze from the perspective of something like a desktop solution, or even, frankly, a network solution, than you can get if you're looking on the email side.
You're right. Like, if you're looking at an email, you know, you are capturing context around the URL that other things might not be able to do.
Right. And we can also rewrite the URL so that every time somebody clicks on it, because it actually can point somewhere else, right? The destination of that URL is not a static thing, the same way that the attachment on an email might be. Actually, a fair percentage of the things that we're detecting now are frankly post-delivery detections, where that URL was good at the time it crossed the gateway and then turned to being malicious later.
Which again, like if you're relying on some sort of thing that goes out and crawls it, that's not necessarily that great, right? So you need to look at just the context of the email and say, is this email good? And it kind of ignore the URL?
Well, yeah, but actually what we do is end up doing click-time sandboxing, right? So every time a user clicks on a rewritten URL, you want to take a new look at it because it can now be malicious in a way it wasn't previously. Hmm. So if you actually open up a URL in a sandbox, which seems like a silly thing to do for Credfish, right? Because it's not malware, but you can really do some interesting analysis of a URL in a sandbox. You can write static signatures that look for like a little bit of code that emails the password back to the attacker or does it as an HTTP post. And even if it is encrypted, you know, we've taken to actually stuffing, after you follow all the redirects, take that credential phishing site, stuff it with legitimate looking credentials, PCAP that output and write signatures for it, because the attackers are not yet doing countermeasures on that kind of detection. And it's really being quite meaningful in detecting more fish. And when you get fished at a very high rate, you're just going to have a bad time in other places. Compromised users.
This is the other aspect that I wanted to speak about, because you pointed out that these Nigerian gangs have moved on to doing really successful credential-based phishing attacks on organizations where they're like rerouting pay packets and stuff, and it works.
Yeah.
People are losing like legit money out of this.
No, absolutely, and they're not the threat actors that everybody thinks is cool to cover, right? That no one's going to call these guys APTs. They infect themselves with their own malware half the time.
Yeah.
Whether it's to test it or accidentally, we can't really say.
Flutterbingers.
They have terrible ops.
Whoopsie
yeah,
daisy.
They have terrible OPSEC. You know, nothing about them really points to the fact that you should pay attention, other than the fact that they're making huge amounts of money.
Yeah.
Right. These are things that get covered as, you know, business email compromised by the FBI. Their number's up to $6 billion globally. This is real money. It's bigger than the ransomware money. And their MO is to fish people. They move laterally through email, and they have APT like speed in terms of how fast they're going to log into a compromised account. And the first thing that they're going to do, they're going to start sending email. And if you're not actually looking for that, it's quite challenging to actually find what looks like, frankly, internal phishing attacks.
It's interesting to sort of draw that parallel between sort of internal phishing attacks and the lateral movement of an attacker on the network, right? Because it's a similar methodology.
It absolutely is. And in this case, you also see, you know, a lot of them go in and change the that apply to given mailboxes. You know, they do things like the same way that you delete basically security logs from a host you've compromised. You can delete that notification of the funny login that O365 or G Suite is sending you when your login behavior doesn't match what they're expecting. You know, when you have control of an email account, you can do all those things. And very often they're doing, you know, custom rule configurations to send stolen email to themselves. And it just becomes a pain to root these guys out once they've gotten into a network, once they've started reading people's email, and once they've proliferated internally, fished other other people, and then pivoted over, as you said, to systems like the payroll system, and are actually rerouting pay packets.
It's interesting. You actually mentioned too that DocuSign phishing is the new black with these people, which I think absolutely. Is funny, right? Yeah. Like DocuSign phishing, like why not?
Well, it's a wonderfully effective lure, and very often it's coming from somebody you expect to be doing business with you in that way. Right, DocuSign and Dropbox are the two most effective lures by percentage right now across our data set.
But DocuSign gets you better creds, right?
It gives you better creds, right? And Dropbox is not always linked to your corporate creds, and very often DocuSign is.
Yes, exactly. Now, Ryan, I know that you make the case that that by using a service like Proofpoint, you're basically knocking out, you know, a lot more nefarious activity than people might expect. And you certainly are keen for people to see services such as yours into the same bucket, you know, belong in the same bucket as things like 2FA and patching. It's like just basic hygiene. Sell me on that idea.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you have to look at what is actually going to make your life as a security person easier. And if you are operating a really sophisticated environment with defense in depth and tons of different tools, it might not matter that your front door is wide open from an email perspective. But if you're resource constrained, it is simply easier to operate when you don't have compromised credentials, compromised endpoints, because again, that initial compromise is largely happening through the email vector.
It is a lot more email than drive-by these days, isn't it? I mean, that, you know, we have really moved into that era.
Oh, absolutely. Exploit kits, and they're not completely dead, but they're basically dead.
They're looking a bit wheezy.
Exactly. And they don't have easily exploitable vulns to rely on. So if you look at where those initial compromises are occurring now, it's so much more common for an attacker to target an email, because it's very easy to figure out what somebody's email address is, who has the access to the thing that you want, and go after them directly, than to find a vulnerability in infrastructure and pivot over to where you want to be. Now, why do something hard when you can do something easy from the attacker's perspective? But from the defender's perspective, you'll see, and this is something that you can test. It's very easy to see what your email stream contains from a malware perspective, a phish perspective, a spoofed email, kind of BEC style. All of that's really, really easy to see, and it does make a meaningful difference in the amount of incidents that ever get to the SOC when you have that front door a little more closed than it would otherwise be.
It's funny. I'm just a humble Gmail user, but when I go and take a little wander through my spam folder, it is such a horror show, such a horror show.
Well, exactly. And the average enterprise mailbox sees about 8x the amount of threats as the average consumer mailbox, which is a big flip from the way it used to be.
I will just mention before we wrap this up that in 2003, I worked as a staff journalist for ZDNet in Sydney, which was back then the equivalent of news.com. They just had it branded under ZDNet. Our email addresses went out on every story that we published, right?
Oh, brutal.
So, I mean, that email address was the most toxic thing ever. And we would literally spend the first 20 minutes of our days. And, you know, that's what it was like 10 plus years ago. You would literally get to the office and spend the first part of your morning deleting spam. So it's good that this is a problem that is at least, you know, mostly solved from a productivity point of view, if not entirely from a security point of view yet. But Ryan Callenby, you make a very solid case for Proofpoint. Thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to share with us your pitch.
Thanks, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
That was Ryan Callenby of Proofpoint there. Check them out at proofpoint.com or go back and have a listen to some of the other interviews I've done with Ryan. I've gotten to know Ryan a little bit over the last little while, and he really is across his field in a pretty impressive way. Okay, it is time to talk SIEM now with Exabeam. From day one, Exabeam was a startup that meant business. As you'll hear, they started off as a SIEM helper company, and they've gradually built out their own product from there. Now they're going after the established SIEM market. Well, they have been for a while, I guess. Think of, you know, that established market as being Splunk and ArcSight and those types of companies. Despite only being 5 years old, Exabeam has quickly established itself as a genuine player in the SIEM space. And why not? They make a pretty compelling argument that the most popular SIEM products have gone stale. Anu Yamanan is the VP of products at Exabeam, and she's here to explain the general pitch behind all next generation Seam gear. The idea is to go beyond the event log and build a timeline of events with your Seam that actually has some context around it. SOC analysts, Seam specialists, and CISOs will be interested to hear what she has to say here. I caught up with Anu to talk about all of this, and here's what she had to say.
If you look at kind of the traditional SIEM vendors, even when they enter into the user behavior analytics market, and if you look at the tools that they've architected, they are built to record and detect the attacks that are kind of built for, architected for yesterday's threat landscape. And I can give you an example there, right? When you look at yesterday's attack, they are transactional, single dimensional, typically involve single user identities or entities, and they are usually from a known attack vector or signature.
Yeah, I mean, it's because I got sent some briefing notes for this interview, and that really resonated with me when, because, you know, I've spent some time in front of an IDS console, right? And that's what it used to be. It was signature based, and it was kind of up to the SOC analyst to figure out the context from their own knowledge of the environment. And, you know, considering the complexity of environments these days, that's just not realistic.
That's right. So just to extend your example of an IDS alert or a FireEye alert or a Palo Alto alert, you know, what typically analysts would do is take that alert, figure out what the IP associated with that alert was, and then go down the path of hunting in the SIEM to figure out, you know, what were the entities involved, what were the users involved. And, you know, it's a very manually intensive task, and you can lose sight of the scent, especially if there were multiple identities involved or multiple assets involved and so forth. So that's kind of the problem that we saw with the traditional SIEM.
But I mean, it's all about this concept. I mean, you know, Exabeam's talking a lot about how once you, you know, bring that context in, you sort of wind up with less of a one-dimensional timeline and much more of a, you know, fully painted picture, right?
Absolutely right. So when we started the company, we saw that modern attacks are persistent. They lasted long, you know, periods of time, whether it's months or years. They're multidimensional in nature. And kind of the nature of business is also evolving, where a single person can have multiple identities, maybe a cloud identity versus a data center identity. And even within data center, I might have admin privileges and so forth. So we are talking about fragmented identities, assets changing IP addresses over the course of time. And more importantly, the attack vector is also highly customized and very targeted. And there is no way to write a signature that will be useful or forward-looking. For this, you know, amount of information, there is no way you can just look at discrete events and picture the entire attack timeline or the entire attack chain. So we kind of came from that perspective that it's no longer feasible for analysts to look at discrete events. And for a modern SIEM, what you need is being able to record timelines and the order in which things happen to deal with the persistent nature of attacks. You need to be able to figure out the scope of affected systems, and this needs to be captured as part of the timeline object. You need to have the contextual information, whether that is the IP address to host association or the multiple identities that a user has or the peer groups that the asset belongs to or the user belongs to, and the network zones that they connect from, and all the associated contextual information regarding an environment. On top of it, we believe that static correlation rules kind of deal with known attacks and are not suitable for the new unknown persistent target attacks. So from that perspective, you need to build behavioral patterns. You need to understand what is normal for a user and asset. You can then identify anomalous behaviors associated with modern threats. Mm. And finally, all of this can only be done with a new type of data structure, what we call as the timeline model, that constitutes both the behavioral patterns as well as the contextual information.
Yeah. Now, I know that when Exabeam was founded, I mean, two companies very much on the target list of companies that you were going to compete with would have been ArcSight and Splunk, right? Because, yep. And I can remember like getting a Splunk demo. They even flew me to Sydney because they had one of their US execs out. And he gave me this amazing demonstration showing me all of the data types that he could pull out of it and stuff that he could stitch together. But even then, years ago, I was thinking, this is really powerful, but unless you're an expert and you kind of know the environment pretty well already, I don't know how much real world gain you're going to get from this. Now, it looks like that's really what you're trying to address by designing, a so-called next gen platform. But when we start, when we have this conversation, it just sounds all really a little bit macro level and hand wavy. So why don't you walk us through, like, practically how you actually plumb this into an enterprise? Because it's all very well and good having these capabilities, but they're only good, as in the case of Splunk, they're only good if you can actually use them. Like, how do you make this a, you know, something that's actually achievable?
Yeah, so, you know, the whole premise of Exabeam has always been, so we have the entire suite of products, right from our data lake, that's a log aggregation, to our advanced analytics, which is the use of entity behavior analytics, and then our incident response, which consists of both case management and automated playbooks, right? So from a plugging into an enterprise environment, we are to a certain degree SIM agnostic. We can plug into an existing traditional SIM so that we can show immediate value and build these timeline objects that include the contextual information that models normal behavior.
Well, I just want to stop you there, because ironically enough, Exabeam kind of started doing UEBA for Splunk, right?
That is right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's just funny that it's like...
as a SIM helper to begin with, and then we became the next-gen SIM, because we also realized that that timeline object is critical across the entire platform. That's one part of it. The second part of it is, for you to effectively connect the dots, you need to be able to collect the dots. And for that, we need to provide a platform where you are not constrained by a flat, you know, by kind of the byte-based pricing model.
Yeah. No, I remember that's key, is like, because people are being, you know, charged per event, and that gets out of hand. You know, that was a great model for the vendors, but as, you know, the number of events increased, it just got a little bit out of hand for most people.
That's right. So now, coming back to, you used an example of, you know, Splunk and how as an analyst needs to kind of go and figure out the attack timeline, the attack chain, start with a discrete event, and how they go about manually assembling this. And this can take multiple hours, or in some cases, it's impossible. What Exabeam has done to kind of address that problem is, we create these timeline objects whereby we are able to assemble the events into this, you know, into timelines. As an example, regardless of whether you're entering into an environment physically via badge access, followed by VPN, followed by, you know, you're authenticating into Windows, accessing databases and so forth, all of that is constructed in a timeline, even as you switch identities and so forth, okay? What that enables analysts to do is, again, going back to, you know, you're no longer dealing with a discrete alert. Even when you're coming with a discrete alert, I got a FireEye incident on this specific IP address. With these timeline objects, you see, you know, which asset was that FireEye alert associated with it, who were the users that were part of, you know, that were on that particular asset at that point in time, what were all the users and entities that were associated with that asset. Now, for example, you know, from this asset, the attacker jumped to a different asset and so forth. You have a complete picture of the timeline collected within Exabeam.
So it's interesting because, you know, the company's roots as a SIM helper have sort of, you know, really, really kind of come into focus during a conversation like this, because essentially what you're saying is, you know, you are quite agnostic, and that, you know, if you've already got something like Splunk, I mean, Exabeam, you can just add, it can take data sources from whatever, and then you can really just have your Exabeam console adding this context and developing a richer data set. I mean, that seems to be the pitch that you're outlining today, right?
That is right. On top of it, what we have, the way we've evolved Exabeam is, you know, as you mentioned, we started as an advanced analytics platform, and then we became the next gen SIM platform. And the kind of what propelled us towards this journey is, you know, when we went down this path, we also realized that because of the SIM licensing constraints, you know, our security teams are not able to collect all the logs. For example, they have an EDR project, the endpoint detection response project, and that brings in a significantly higher volume than what SIMs are currently capable of handling or they're licensed to handle. And that's very valuable information that you can use analytics on top of. Okay, so we have seen Exabeam used as the complete suite of Exabeam used as an augmentation play to a traditional SIM, whereby you're sending your low volume feeds into your SIM, and then you're onboarding your new data sources into Exabeam so that you don't have to worry about the licensing costs, and then still get the value of analytics on all your data. So the idea is the new data sources are being pushed into Exabeam Data Lake, and then it flows into advanced analytics, and we are kind of analyzing both your, you know, for example, your Splunk data sources as well as the Exabeam Data Lake log feeds.
So that's interesting. So you can sort of start gently and just maybe take certain input feeds and then, you know, gradually switch over.
That is right, because you know, in some cases, our customers have made you know multi-year investment in SIEM. It's not a simple switch, but we do have certain class of customers that have made the transition. They realize that the value is in detection and in response, not in collection. Log collection, from our perspective, is a commodity, mm-hmm. especially with the advent of big data technologies, whether it's Hadoop, powered by Hadoop, or Elasticsearch. You know, the premium is in being able to detect the threats and then being able to respond to threats, automating the response to threats.
Anu Yamanan, thank you very much for joining us on SnakeOilers. That was all very interesting stuff.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
That was Anu Yamanan there, rounding out the totally inaccurately named June SnakeOilers edition. Big thanks to her for that. And that company is Exabeam. You can find them at exabeam.com, exabeam.com. And I think it's a pretty uncontroversial thing to say that if you're looking at, you know, doing some SIEM project, you'd be well served by at least having a look at what Exabeam is up to. And that is it for this edition of the show. I'll be back next week with a Soapbox podcast all about machine learning in InfoSec with machine learning true believer, Christopher Sestito of Silence. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.